have white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. I'm a well-dressed man, waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows, with my head in the news. It is now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and time strange. Lock me tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, things have changed. This place ain't doing me any wrong town, should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge. A lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and time is strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. What a difference 24 hours can make. This mic down here in Arizona land. Today's date is the 25th of June, 2018. It's a Monday. Your mind is your primary weapon. And you're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. We'll continue our block of instruction of about the colonial war and the French experience, wrapping up the part leading up to Dien Bien Phu in French Indochina. My email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com, altabeeb762@hotmail.com. As always, we're sending this out to Lily Grace Antoinette. The call-in number for Liberty Tree Radio is 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900. The voice will come on, ask for the room number, and that's 957-464, and then the pound sign. And if you'd like to come up and participate, ask a question, clarification, comment, you can star 6, we'll unmute your telephone. I also have quite a bit of border news, not the distraction border news about crying babies ripped from their mother's arms and all that distraction. It just seems like this is a double or a triple distraction of about what's going on the border. Longtime listeners know that I cover a tremendous amount of the things that are going on in Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, et cetera, Brazil, Argentina. And I kind of wonder sometimes why the news media doesn't. And pretty sure I know what the answer is, but that's a different deal. But as this investigation and collusion and the Russians and Mueller at fizzling out, so then they had to have another distraction, and we got the IG's report coming out, but we can't talk about that and let that bump the news off, or the distraction from and the fizzling out of the Mueller investigation, so we have to come up with something else. Oh, that's it. Let's go down to the border. All of a sudden now we're interested on what's going on in the border, but only to a certain extent. And then we'll search high and low for just that right picture, the optics. This first news item, BorderlandBeat.com, 11 June 2018. Boss of Cartel de Tigre arrested in Chihuahua. Elements of the State Commission for Security and the Federal Police detained one Jesus Manuel Biel, alias El Chuma, alleged new boss of the Cartel de Tigre. The Attorney General of the state informed that after the capture of Julio Escarcega, El Chumo had assumed command of the criminal group. Together with El Chumo were arrested another two persons called Espiridio CP, alias El Zari, and Jose Luis RP, nickname L77, who, added the functionary, with no members of the criminal cell that operates in the region and who worked for Escar Gamboa Sosa, alias El Once. The arrest was made in the municipal capital of Novo Ama, where the troops carried out patrols when they noticed the presence of three armed men. The alleged criminals fled when they noticed the police presence, but after the chase, the officers managed to thwart their escape attempt and arrest the three armed men. They confiscated an AK-47, a 9mm Uzi submachine gun, a 2008 Nissan Sentra, and a Rabone truck. In addition, more than 2 kilos of marijuana and 6,000 liters of fuel were uncovered. After the arrest, the State Security Commissioner Oscar Alberto Aparicio Francisco Avandado indicated the cooperation will continue to strengthen the integral beefing up of forces in the mountainous region of the state to take organized crime head-on. The detainees and all the confiscated items remain at the disposal of PGE, which will carry out the subsequent investigation. Here's another. Now, this one happened in the United States, but, of course, I don't recall hearing anything about it. Borderlandbeat.com, 11 June 2018. It's kind of the continuing saga. We covered about LaBarbie years ago when he was first arrested and extradited to the United States. Edgar LaBarbie Valdez Villarreal was arrested in Mexico in 2010, extradited to the U.S. in September of 15. He pleaded guilty in January 2016 to charges of conspiring to import and distribute cocaine and conspiring to launder money. He was sentenced today in Atlanta in a hearing slated for 9:30 a.m. Prosecutors were asking court to send him to prison for 55 years, 660 months, and ordered to him to forfeit $192 million. He is facing leaving prison in a pine box before he cut a deal. His sentencing is sealed, which probably indicates will he'll testify against one or more defendants, with the trial of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman closing in. A good guess is that Valdez will be on the witness list. He is a witness list against Alfredo El Mechomo Beltran Leyva. Beltran Leyva pleaded guilty and did not seek a plea deal. After the particulars were sealed, the media reported that the sentencing to the 50 years the government was asking for, 27-page government sentencing memorandum, a historical background of Valdez and details of his criminal life and interactions with others, including Zetas and Ociel Cardenas. But no, I'm not going to go into 27 pages of BorderlandBeat.com. 11 June 2018, Mexico not pressing massive bribery charges due to election. The investigation into alleged acts of corruption of officials of the government of President Enrique Peña Nieto in the Odebrecht case have been hampered because it could affect the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, ahead of the elections on July 1, say three people interviewed. According to what these three people told the newspaper, the millions of dollars in bribes from Odebrecht were paid to the office officials who worked for the company Petróleos Mexicanos, Pemex, through accounts in the tax havens to guarantee infrastructure contracts. The contracts, payment of bribes, and money transfers that were revealed by the Brazilian government and Mexico media on the case are collaborated with the files that are part of the investigación. However, Mexican authorities did not extend the investigation to seek new contracts or payments that the Brazilian government may have overlooked, the three people who know the case told the media. The note published points out that after resigning from the Attorney General's office, the PGR, Raul Cervantes, the ex-director of the unit, said publicly that the investigation was concluded. On the other hand, his successor, the acting Attorney General, Alberto Elias Beltran, has contradicted these declarations when suggesting that the investigación continue and therefore the PGR cannot divulge details on the advance in the case. No official has been accused of accepting bribes from Odebrecht, and the other sanctions so far is an impediment to participate in public contracting with the company. That's something that's been going on for quite a while. We've covered it a mazillion times here on Your Mind as Your Primary Weapon. Borderlandbeat.com, 12 June 2018, video, Narcolab and Huachicol found in the basement of the municipal palace in EDMX, Mexico State. In clandestine places often hidden from society, clandestine drug labs have been located, but this time was different. In the basement of the municipal palace in the municipality of Isidro Fabela, a center of distribution of stolen fuel is located, along with deposits with chemical materials and various implements found to treat these materials. The investigation have established that this site was used as a laboratory to produce some type of synthetic drug in the community of Tizala. The finding was made by the elements of the Army and the Office of the Attorney General of Justice, who are carried out operations in Notas Nicolas Romero and another place that's hard to pronounce. Among the properties that were secured in the basement of the municipal palace of Isidro Fabela were several containers, some of these empty, but that gave off a strong odor of combustible, and four drums filled with gasoline with capacity. Borderlandbeat.com, 12 June 2018, Jalisco. Mencho on the run as Mexican Navy in hot pursuit. At the time of her arrest, Rosalinda Gonzalez Valencia, wife of Nemesio Osguerra, alias El Mencho, immediately destroyed her cell phone. They are not unpremeditated, high-level sources said CIMAR yesterday. They emphasized that the head of the Jalisco cartel Nuevo Generacion is furious over the capture of his spouse, but that the lethal reaction they expected after the capture of the woman has not occurred. We surprised him, an admiral told us. Rosalinda Gonzalez is suspected of being the administrator of the economic resources of the criminal group. A court order is sought for the crimes of organized crime. We sent to the Secretary of Navy with the intention of knowing how the issues of the seafarers were attacked in Ciudad Guzman, Jalisco, on the morning of Tuesday while they replenished their vehicles. Borderlandbeat.com, 13 June 2018, precursor providers to Sinaloa and CJNG DTOs. The names of Ezio Benjamin Figueroa Vasquez and his son, Hussein Figueroa Gomez, first sounded in 2012 when they were designated drug lords by the Office of Foreign Asset Control and of the U.S. Department of Treasury. The accusations were formalized after, in November 11, Figueroa Vasquez was captured due to his links with Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, according to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. These are the main distributors of pseudoephedrine and ephedrine that Mexican cartels employ, dedicated to producing methamphetamine for the U.S. market using a network that goes from Europe and sub-Sahara Africa to our country. According to the Federal Court of the Eastern District of Virginia, they resorted to suppliers in countries where such criminal precursors are legal. In the investigation, Belgium cooperated as part of the global effort to intercept the access of Mexican drug trafficking organizations, said the DEA. This is kind of another follow-up. Tied to BorderlandBeat.com, 14 June 2018, Mexican narcos invest in Dubai. The luxurious city of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates has become in recent years a den of international magnates enriched with criminal capital and sanctioned by the United States Treasury. Along with smugglers of nuclear material, sponsors of armed conflicts, kleptocrats, money launderers, and financial terrorists, also appears Mexican Hussein Eduardo Figueroa Gomez, a businessman from Jalisco who, along with his father, Ezio Benjamin Figueroa Vasquez, has identified a drug trafficking ringleader by the Kingpin Act of 2012. The Sandcastle Tracing Sanctions Evasion, through Dubai Luxury Real Estate Market Report from the private firm Center for Advanced Defense Studies, C4ADS, located in Washington, to which Universal has access. Figueroa Gomez and Figueroa Vasquez are accused by the U.S. of trafficking tons of chemical precursors from Europe and sub-Sahara Africa to Mexico to sell to the Mexican cartels to produce methamphetamine. Ezio Benjamin Figueroa Vasquez was arrested in Mexico in 2011, while Hussein Eduardo Figueroa Gomez remains a fugitive. Despite this, C4ADS points out, it seems to have used Dubai as a base to continue the commercial activities through transactions of at least $4.34 million in luxury goods. BorderlandBeat.com, 14 June 2018. Karina Sanchez Valdez of Los Zetas sentenced to 34 years in prison. A federal judge in the state of Mexico sentenced Karina Sanchez Vasquez Valdez, a member of the Zeta cartel in Nuevo León, who was commanded by Sigfrido Nayara Tamamontes El Canicon, to 34 years in prison. The first district judge in the federal criminal proceedings in the state of Mexico found that this woman guilty of organized crime in the form of laundering, crimes against health, and stockpiling of firearms and possession of cartridges for the exclusive use of the Army reported PGR. In addition to the prison sentence, the Justice Minister imposed a payment of a fine of $3,674 days of salary. Sanchez Valdez was arrested in March 20, 2009 by elements of the National Defense Secretariat in Saltito, Cholula, along with El Canicon and five other of her alleged lieutenants. In the capture operations, they secured 24 grenades, 8 rifles, 3 handguns, a grenade launcher, magazines, cartridges, 5 vehicles, and 10,110,700 pesos. How does that come out to about 24 cents? On September 7, 2015, El Canicon was found dead in his prison cell in Altiplano. His death was apparently a result of cardiorespiratory arrest. Yeah, right. Okay, enough of that. I got scads of this stuff. I got more of this stuff than I can report on, but being that we're limited in today's broadcast to just 1 hour, we're just going to call that and leave it at that. We're right down here to the bottom of the hour. Most likely we'll hear the bumper music coming in here in just a minute. But until then, switching gears here, last Monday we were talking about the colonial war and the French experience. A pretty famous writer, Bernard Fall, that he wrote in his book, Two Vietnams. And he points out that by the end of the month of October 1950, almost the whole northern half of the bumper music is playing. And it's no fun being an illegal alien. We'll be right back in a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Don't go nowhere. Stay tuned. Thank you. And an illegal onion. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. 25 June 2018. It's a Monday. You are tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. We're in the last 25 minutes of today's broadcast. And as always, we send this one out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Those first two words phonetically, Alpha, Lima, Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. The first 30 minutes of today's broadcast covered some stuff, quite a bit of border information, asking the questions of about why didn't we hear about the sentencing of LaBarbie in Atlanta, but we can hear about some crying child down on the border and how evil President Trump is. We're broadcasting here on Liberty Tree Radio, and I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to tune in today, and thank you for helping keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. You can, I think, what is it, libertytreeradio.4mg.com. And I think you can listen live there, or a mirror site or something like that. And then you can also, if you have a telephone, doesn't have to have a smartphone, iPhone, shoulder bone, it doesn't matter, saxophone, trombone, you can dial 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900. And then the voice comes on, asks for the room number, and that's 957-464, and then the pound sign. And if you'd like to come up and you just push *6, we'll unmute your phone. Bob Miner, telephone number, contact information, 701-251-2365, 701-251-2365. If you'd like to send him a letter, Robert Miner, M-I-N-E-R, S-C-C-C, 205 6th Street, Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Robert Miner, the initials, the four of them, are Sierra, Charlie, 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 205 6th Street, Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. And also to get the word out, that also broadcast over on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday, starting at the same time. It would be 8 a.m. Arizona time. I think we're mountain this time of the year. It's always so confusing. Half of the year we're on mountain, half of the year we're on Pacific, when everybody does this spring forward in the spring and fall back in the fall. And actually it's a opposite accordion type of effect here. While everybody springs forward, we actually fall back. And don't ask me, I can explain it to you and you're still going to be confused. So, but anyway, this time of the year, right now, I have about 21 minutes till 9 a.m. Arizona time. I wish that they would just figure something out, but we all just need to switch over to 24-hour clock, Greenwich Mean Time, GMT, Universal Time Coordinated, but I'm going to hold my breath. So when we left off at the bottom of the hour, before we got our It's No Fun, Being an Illegal Alien, everybody's singing and dancing around to that. We were talking about Bernard Fall's book, The Two Vietnams. And he writes, by the end of the month of October 1950, almost the whole northern half of Vietnam had become a Viet Minh redoubt, into which the French were, with the brief exception of a paratroop raid on Lang Song in July of 1953, never to penetrate again. When the smoke had cleared, the French had suffered their greatest colonial defeat since Montcalm had died at Quebec. They had lost 6,000 troops, 13 artillery pieces, 125 mortars, 450 trucks, and 3 armored platoons, 940 machine guns, 1,200 submachine guns, and more than 8,000 rifles. Their abandoned stock alone sufficed for the equipment of a whole Viet Minh division. For the French, Fall concludes, the Indochina War was lost then and there. And that it was allowed to drag on inconclusively for another 4 years is a testimony to the short-sightedness of the civilian authorities who were charged with drawing the political conclusion from the hopeless military situation. American military aid, the first trickle of which had made its appearance in the form of 7 transport planes in June of 1950 after the Korean War had broken out, was to make no difference whatever in the eventual outcome of the war. The progress of the Viet Minh was slowed to some extent by General Ziap's premature decision at the end of 1950 to begin a general offensive, the attempt to force the campaign into Mao's decisive third stage of Revolutionary War, the strategic offensive. When the situation was not yet ripe, cost the Viet Minh heavily in a single clash in the Red River Delta area, January 16 to 17, Ziap lost 6,000 men. When he tried to seize the port of Haiphong in March of 1951, he was again defeated, and in June, a third drive for control of the Delta likewise failed. Thereafter, the Viet Minh wisely transferred their efforts to more promising objectives, in particular, the control of the highland areas where heavy artillery, air power, and armor could not be brought fully into play, and the French had to fight on the Viet Minh terms, another key part of about insurgency. The key military problem for the French in Indochina was a lack of manpower. Their main political problem was lack of support on the home front. Diplomatic pressures added to these problems. Viet Minh strategy was flexible, that the French were comparatively rigid, so that time and again the Expeditionary Corps was caught off balance. Lack of manpower meant that too few troops were required to cover too much territory, with the result that the Corps was unable to meet the lightning blows of fast-moving Viet Minh mobile divisions when these concentrated for the offensive. And when the French themselves went on the offensive and tried to concentrate their forces to seize the initiative in a given sector, Viet Minh guerrilla action elsewhere along the line made them spread out again. Moreover, Viet Minh strategy, being political, as well as military, was designed to increase the political and psychological pressure on the enemy and was singly successful in accomplishing the objective. The point is well illustrated by Ziap's invasion of Laos in the early spring of 1953. The invasion was launched with three Viet Minh divisions, supported initially by some 4,000 Pathet Lao guerrillas. In opposition were only 3,000 French troops backed by the Laotian army of 10,000 men. Rather than sacrifice the thinly manned frontier garrisons, the French command ordered them to withdraw, leaving only a single battalion to offer rearguard resistance. The battalion was lost. Only four men survived. Another garrison retreating inland lost all but 180 of its 2,400 troops in the disastrous fighting withdrawal. Reinforcements airlifted into Laos from Vietnam stemmed the invasion on the Plain of Jars, but at the cost of further depletion of French reserves in the main area of hostilities and tying up all available French air transport. The Viet Minh were beaten back, but the campaign was, from their point of view, far from a wasted effort. The Katzenbach comment in Time, Space, and Will, accomplished with so little. He writes, perhaps in the cold light of afterthought, the most curious aspect of the whole action was that from the beginning it made a mockery of the old saying, nothing risked, nothing gained. Whatever the gain, no military investment of some sizable proportion was risked. This was quite as safe a venture, in a word, as the Chinese invasion of Tibet. Yet after three-week invasion, this is what the communists had accomplished. One, they had thrown terror into the French, the military, and the civil authorities alike in both Indochina and metropolitan France. Two, they had spread French forces defending forces in Indochina even thinner than previously. Three, they had produced renewed demands for a larger measure of political autonomy in both Laos and nearby Cambodia. Four, they had created a situation in which the French spending in the area was raised by some $60 million. And five, they had cost the United States some $460 million extra by the way of foreign aid. One of the most interesting accounts of revolutionary warfare that has been written is Vo Nguyen Giap's own account of the Viet Minh strategy used to block the well-publicized Navarra plan, France's last gasp effort, as it turned out, to regain the military initiative in Indochina. The plan conceived by the latest of a succession of French commanders-in-chief, General Henri Navarre, envisioned a strategic offensive designed, as the late John Foster Dulles assured a committee of the United States Senate, to, quote, break the organized body of communist aggression by the end of the 1955 fighting season in 18 months, end quote. Navarre conceded privately in a secret report not published until long after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu that the war in Indochina was already lost when the Navarre plan went into effect. The best that could be hoped for even at that time was a stalemate. Be that as it may, the plan was put into operation with powerful financial and material assistance from the United States. Navarre's strategy was to concentrate strong mobile forces in the Red River Delta in an effort to engage and wear down the main body of the Viet Minh during the fall and winter of 1953, while at the same time occupying Dien Bien Phu to the west as a springboard from which to launch powerful stabs at communist free zones in the surrounding area. With the spring of 1954, the Viet Minh presumably being exhausted by this time, the French were to speed other newly formed units to seize Viet Minh free zones in South Vietnam. This mop-up to be followed by a general offensive in the north that would bring the war to a successful conclusion. 44 French mobile battalions were concentrated in the Red River Delta for the first phase of the operation. And during the fall of 1953, and a series of fierce battles followed, in January, French paratroopers occupied Dien Bien Phu, and a powerful buildup there began. The Viet Minh, meanwhile, launched their counteroffensive, encircling Dien Bien Phu, joining forces with the Pathet Lao for a stab in the Upper Laos, followed in January by an offensive in the Western Highlands and two further thrusts into Laos, one in the south and the other in the north, the latter liberating Nam Hu Basin and threatening the Laotian capital, Luang Prabang. Now, in March, as the French regrouped to resume their offensive, the Viet Minh opened their historic 55-day assault on Dien Bien Phu. The strategic direction of Dien Bien Phu campaign and the winter of 1953, spring of 54 campaign in general, writes General Ziap, was a typical success of the revolutionary military line of Marxist-Leninism applied to the actual conditions of the Revolutionary War in Vietnam. He writes, "Our strategy started from thorough analysis of the enemy's contradictions. It aimed at concentrating our forces in the enemy's relatively exposed sectors, annihilating their manpower, liberating a part of the territory, and compelling them to scatter their forces, thus creating favorable conditions for a decisive victory. For the French Expeditionary Corps, the war was a continuous process of dispersal of forces. The enemy divisions were split into regiments, then into battalions, companies, and platoons to be stationed at thousands of points and posts on the various battlefronts of the Indochina theater of operation. The enemy found himself face to face with a contradiction. Without scattering the forces, it would be impossible for him to occupy the invaded territory. In scattering his forces, he put himself in difficulties. The scattered units would fall easy prey to our troops. Their mobile forces would be more and more reduced, and the shortage of troops would be all the more acute. On the other hand, if they concentrated their forces to move from the defensive position and cope with us with more initiative, the occupation forces would be weakened and it would be difficult for them to hold the invaded territory. Now, if the enemy gives up occupied territory, the very aim of the war of reconquest is defeated." So, the objectives of the Navarra Plan have already been stated. Now, in preparing to put the plan into the operation, the French found themselves faced with a dilemma. They could not go on the offensive without concentrating their manpower, yet would be unable to defend the many weak links in the strategic chain of defensive posts if they did concentrate. And the lack of the manpower was the crippling factor. And to make up for the deficiencies, new units were formed. Many consisted of Vietnamese recruits, or as the Viet Minh insisted, mercenaries. An existing unit stationed at posts that were considered static were secretly shifted from the big buildup in the Red River Delta. And needless to say, the Navarra Plan confronted the Viet Minh with the necessity of making serious decisions also. Ziap recounts the dilemma. Quote, "The concrete problem was the enemy was concentrating in the Red River Delta and launching attacks on our free zones. Now, should we concentrate our forces to face the enemy or mobilize them for attacks in other directions? In concentrating our forces to fight the enemy in the Delta, we could defend our free zones, but here the enemy was still strong and we could easily be decimated. On the other hand, in attacking in other directions with our main force, we could exploit the vulnerable points of the enemy to annihilate the bulk of their forces, but our free zone would thus be threatened." The Communist Party's Central Committee put its collective mind to the problem, Ziap somberly relates, and came up with the slogan, "Dynamism, initiative, mobility, and rapidity of decision in the face of new situations." While less than informative, the slogan did have meaning, as Ziap explains. "Keeping the initiative, we should concentrate our forces to attack strategic points, which were relatively vulnerable. If we succeeded in keeping the initiative, we could achieve success and then compel the enemy to scatter their forces. On the other hand, if we were driven on the defensive, not only could we not annihilate many enemy forces, but our own forces could easily suffer losses. A dynamic campaign that was decided upon, always conceived that the essential thing was to destroy the enemy's manpower. The Central Committee worked out its plan of action by scientific analysis to concentrate our offensive against important strategic points where the enemy were relatively weak in order to wipe out a part of their manpower, and at the same time compelling them to scatter their forces to cope with us at vital points which they had to defend at all costs. This strategy proved correct. While the enemy was concentrating big forces in the Delta to threaten our free zone instead of leaving our main forces in the Delta or scattering our forces in the free zone to defend it by a defensive action, we regrouped our forces and boldly attacked in the direction of the Northwest, end quote. The result was the destruction, says the app, of thousands of local bandits armed by the French, and the liberation of four strategic strong points, the destruction of a greater part of the French column, and the encirclement of Dien Bien Phu, thus compelling the enemy to carry out in haste a reinforcement movement to save it from being wiped out. Ziap adds a significant observation. In addition to the Red River Delta, Dien Bien Phu thus became a second point of concentration of the enemy forces. Now, at the same time, the Middle Laos offensive was in progress, forcing the French to rush more reinforcements in another direction and so to weaken further the buildup in the Delta, while creating a third point of concentration at the threatened air base of Sinop. Further diversions were created, including a Viet Minh assault on the Western Highlands and the offensive in Upper Laos, sending French reinforcements speeding in two new directions. For us, Ziap writes, the first phase of the winter-spring campaign was a series of offenses launched simultaneously on various important sectors while the enemy were relatively exposed, in which we annihilated part of the enemy's forces and liberated occupied areas, at the same time compelling the enemy to scatter their forces in many directions. We continually kept the initiative in the operations and drove the enemy on the defensive. On the main battlefront, we pinned down the enemy at Dien Bien Phu, thus creating favorable conditions for our troops on other battlefields. End quote. The result of the Viet Minh strategy was to relieve pressure on the free zone to such an extent that the compatriarchs would go to work, even in daytime without being molested by enemy aircraft, and to keep the French too busy and too scattered for the local mopping up operations which the Navarra plan had envisioned as the prelude to the general offensive against the main body of the Viet Minh forces in the north. In consequence, guerrilla areas behind the French lines in South Vietnam were never eliminated, and with this constant threat added to the pressure on encircled Dien Bien Phu, French hopes of regaining the initiative quickly faded. The Navarra plan was smashed before it could be fairly put into operation, and the destruction of the fortified camp at Dien Bien Phu and the surrender of what remained of its garrison at full strength, it had consisted of 17 infantry battalions, 3 artillery battalions, plus various engineer tank units and paratroopers, defending 49 concrete strong points, was the defensive blow. The battle lasted for 55 days at 1:53 local time on May 8, 1954, writes Bernard Fall. The last gun fell silent at Dien Bien Phu after a desperate bayonet charge of the Algerian and Foreign Legion garrison of Strong Point Isabel, and had been smothered by sheer numbers of the victorious Viet Minh, and the war that had lasted 8 years was almost over. A military survey team sent to Saigon from France to learn the extent of the disaster recommended that the French abandon North Vietnam as a lost cause, and if they could, hold the area below the 17th parallel. The diplomatic settlement in Geneva that followed, bringing peace to Vietnam, but not permanent peace ratified the military decision. The Indochina War ended on July 21, 1954 at 3:43 Wright's Fall. Ever precise. It had cost the French Union a total of 172,000 casualties and forever broke France's hold on Vietnam. And that kind of sums up what happened there. Quite a few of the standard principles of insurgency when they concentrate to attack us, we'll attack in another direction and make them send out their troops. And when they send out their troops, and they'll have all these little outposts and small patrols that are easy to be overwhelmed and prolong and wear the enemy down. I'll also recall that it was not a military action, but it was a political action, not only in Vietnam, but also in France, because they were playing on the heartstrings of the French people that were in this area, and it just is a constant drip, drip, drip strain on them. And eventually, because the Viet Minh knew the area better, it was their backyard, if you will, they knew how to, all the little back roads and the paths that could bypass. While the French were fairly road bound with their tanks and their trucks, so when they'd concentrate, the Viet Minh would just disperse and go out into the jungle in their paths that they had carved through the jungle. That was kind of before what had become famously known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but there were just back ways through the jungle that the entrance to the jungle pass were well concealed. Unless you actually knew where they were, you didn't even know where it was. And because of the dense foliage that the aircraft that the French used for surveillance, they could fly right over the area and not see these trails in the jungle. So there are quite a few of the summary of the principles of insurgency, that it's a political and not military action, that there's multiple fronts that you're working on, and it's not just to attack the enemy where the enemy is, but you want to attack the home front through a psychological type of operation. I see we're coming up to the top of today's broadcast. When we get back next week, we're going to talk about the political character of the second Indochina role, the American responsibility and the expansion of the war, and those aspects of how that all came to be. And again, it was pretty much the same strategy, but we're just going to have another Indochina war. It's kind of interesting, too, reading, Aaron Banks from OSS to Green Beret, how he had met with and traveled with Ho Chi Minh back in post-World War II. Kind of an interesting story on itself, how kind of seems to remind me of a lot of this. One day these people are our friends, and the next minute they're our enemies, whether it's a Saddam Hussein or a Manuel Noriega or a Ho Chi Minh. How we can train these people, parachuting OSS deer team into North Vietnam to train Ho and General Ziap and a small cadre on small unit tactics, weapons, radio communications to fight the Japanese during World War II. And then all of a sudden, now they're the bad guys. Interesting turnabout is fair play aspect of it. You've been a long way today. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 25th of June, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. And as I say, also broadcast over on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday, starting at the same time, 8 a.m. Arizona time, but we go for 2 hours from 8 to 10 on Thursday and Friday. This show here on Liberty Tree Radio is kind of a a primer for the people that are just new to the subject of insurgency, but the stuff on Thursday and Friday is a little bit more advanced. It's good for bringing the new listeners up to speed, and it's also good for a reflection and a recap of the previous lesson. So I hear the bumper music coming in here. I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And as always, we send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. God bless you. I'll see you Thursday, same bat time, different bat station.
Locked and tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't doing me any good. I'm in the wrong town. Should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcut, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and time is strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain used to care, but things have changed. I'm not that eager.